Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is northern ecologist Norman Barrichello. He has spent 44 years in Canada's Arctic and subarctic as a biologist, naturalist guide, and advisor to the... Norman, do you pronounce it as the Kaskadena?
The Kaskadena.
Dena. Yes. And we're talking about his book, Gyr Falcon, The One Who Stays All Winter. Norman, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
We should explain the subtitle, The One Who Stays All Winter. Where does that phrase come from?
It comes from an Inuit word from the Eastern Arctic that Okiatok. It refers to the gyr falcon as the one who stays all winter, because indeed the gyr falcon, if they can afford to, they're up in their Arctic environment all winter.
Wow. For people who are not birders or people who are not ornithologists, gyr falcon is a falcon, but by far the largest falcon. If you've ever seen a peregrine, imagine the peregrine on like steroids. Describe a gyr falcon for people.
Well, it has the characteristic form of a falcon with relatively long pointed wings. It's got a rudder that's a little, tail feathers that are a little longer than the peregrine, so it serves as a pretty good rudder. It's got a head that I think is very noble looking with a relatively small beak, and usually they have a large set of talons. And in the gyr falcon in particular, they've got large feet and feathered leggings, and they come in three predominant colors, white, which can be pure white or flecked, or the common form would be the gray gyr falcon, at least where I live. And then there's a dark form that's very uncommon, but occurs in, I believe it's parts of eastern Quebec, Labrador, and I think there's another small population in Russia that's relatively dark.
Now, these birds are therefore circumpolar?
They're circumpolar, yeah.
They're very thinly distributed. They're not like a common bird at all.
No, they're not, and I think it speaks of the rigors that they face trying to make a living up here. It's, as we all know, that it's... a very long winter and short summer up here. In fact, some people say it's got two seasons, winter and a season of poor sledding. So it's formidable for them. There's not a wide diversity of prey species for them. And, of course, the severe weather, and gyr falcons are further handicapped because they don't make their own nests, so they need to find a ledge or some sort of a stick nest that allows them to nest on.
There's some amazing photographs in this book, and I want to make sure people know that, especially, of course, of the birds, but also of the habitat. And let's talk about their nesting habitat. What are the requirements that they need for nesting habitat?
Well, I think it's really simple, I think, for the most case. It's... they need ptarmigan, population of ptarmigan that's enough for them to survive on and reproduce, and also they need cliffs on which to nest. Now, there's been some areas where gyr falcons will nest in trees, in stick nests built by other birds, commonly the raven, but up here it's cliffs and ptarmigan that are the mainstay. And then, of course, there may be subtleties in terrain that influence their numbers. I suspect they need some kind of topographic relief to benefit in the hunt, and as well as perches for them to hunt from. So, but those could be subtle. It's a question I can't answer very well. But certainly the two requirements are ptarmigan and nesting cliffs, undoubtedly.
Is there do the cliffs have to be a certain height?
Yeah, there's actually some characteristics that I think are essential. One is that they should be around 50 meters or more in height. And if the cliff is too small, it's particularly in the winter, you can get snow that builds up against one side of the cliff, and then you get wolverine in particular that can scale these small cliffs and get access to the gerfalcon nest, and that would be a usual occurrence, but certainly they need a cliff above 50 meters, and I found that they tended to prefer, or at least it appears they preferred, alcoves or areas that have an overhang or sidewalls, and I think this is really important to them for obvious reasons, that as a large bird, they have a long nesting period, and this nesting period goes from February February to late part of August, where the young are actually, where the birds are trying to produce in youngsters that can be independent by early September. And so it's a long, long nesting period, and so they have to begin early if they're going to meet the schedule. And so they're starting to breed they're courting in late February and into March, and they start egg laying in the early part of April. And of course, it's very cold up here. It can be 20 below commonly, and up to 50 below even in late March. And you've got the nest site, of course, that benefits from having some security from the elements, as well as falling rock and the other hazards of nesting on a cliff.
Let's talk about ptarmigan for a minute, because one of the things I gleaned from your book, and it's brought home time and again, is the population of ptarmigan is directly related to how the gerfalcons are doing.
It appears so, yes. And I found in the work that I did that there's a very strong relationship between the number of ptarmigan and gerfalcon breeding numbers. And I suspect particularly the number of young ptarmigan. So when the ptarmigan are doing well, there's generally a good population or a good proportion of youngsters. And I think gers fare better if the population is biased toward the youngsters.
But aren't ptarmigan sort of go through a boom and bust cycle? There are times when... Do we know what that's due to?
Not very well. There's been a whole bunch of theories proposed to explain why they're very abundant, and then they crash, and then they recover again in a cyclic nature, which is about a 10-year cycle. And, so there's a lot of theories as to why... climatic changes due to what is referred to now as oscillations in the Pacific and the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
And of course, food has been suspected to be a driver in the cycle. And also there was an intriguing theory that it has to do with reproductive behavior of ptarmigan. And when there's few ptarmigan, then the advantages given to ptarmigan that have lots of babies but don't look after them very well. And when the densities rise, there's, of course, more ptarmigan, so they have to fight for every little bit of territory. And so the broods are typically smaller. And so the theory was that depending on where you are in the cycle, you get a lot of ptarmigan production or a meager amount of production, which helps drive the cycle. I suspect it's a combination of a whole range of factors, but nobody's been able to really tease them apart very well, to my understanding.
Now, there's three species of ptarmigan in North America, and this is a grouse for people who don't know what we're talking about. But in your study area, in the Yukon, in the Ogilvy Mountains, how do you pronounce that? Ogilvy Mountains. There's only two species of ptarmigan found there, right?
Correct, for the most part. There might be small little isolated pockets of the third species of ptarmigan, the white-tailed ptarmigan, but for the most part it's willow ptarmigan and a smaller number of rock ptarmigan. But if you went to Iceland, you would gerfalcon survive there on entirely rock ptarmigan. There's no willow ptarmigan in Iceland, to my understanding.
Is this the gerfalcon's only winter food then?
It certainly whether they're able to nab the odd gray jay or nab the odd raven, hard to know, but ptarmigan certainly are what maintain them. And without ptarmigan, you wouldn't have deer falcons in the north, and certainly they wouldn't be able to overwinter without enough ptarmigan. In fact, I think the migration of deer falcons into the United States in the winter, I think possibly is influenced by just how many ptarmigan there are in the north. So if they can afford to stay in the north, they will. But when the populations are low, I think they're obligated to leave.
Now, ptarmigan, when I looked at this photographs, and you talk about this in your book, the area, the study area, and other areas that you visited too, it's, would you describe that's mostly tundra, or how would you describe the habitat?
Yeah, I would describe it as mostly tundra. Now,
it's got little stands of willows and stuff, though, right?
Yes, and willow, of course, is common in the tundra, growing particularly in the seepage areas. But, you know, some people make the distinction between alpine and tundra. Tundra is typically that area north of a certain latitude where no trees grow, and alpine is an elevational change, so it's high elevation habitat where no trees grow. But the characteristic of these environments is that there's very few trees. There might be the odd few patches of spruce that are able to form these little islands, but for the most part, there's no trees in this area.
There's a photograph in this book of your study area with your blind in the photograph.
Yes.
That looks like an incredibly tough place to study a bird in winter.
Well, it was certainly challenging getting the blind.
Norman, that's an understatement. It looked amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be one of the loneliest places on the planet. It's one of the least. It's amazing.
Beautiful scenery.
Oh God, it's gorgeous. Except I kept thinking of the cold and the isolation. What are you doing to keep warm? I need to know.
It was challenging. You know, initially I brought up a little heater, little propane, a little camp heater, a propane heater, but I found that it was creating vapor that was coming from the blind that I thought might be disturbing the birds, so I did away with that. So I had no source of heat other than my down jacket and some mitts, but as I say in the book, it was challenging to record notes when it gets cold, and wow, your hands start to have trouble functioning. So, and this was done years ago, and I didn't have the kind of technology that we might have today to record notes, and everything was done through observation and written field notes.
Wow. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is northern ecologist Norman Barrichello. He has spent 44 years in Canada's Arctic and subarctic as a biologist, naturalist guide, and advisor to the Cascadina. We're talking about his book, Deer Falcon, The One Who Stays All Winter. Now, the deer falcon is facing incredible challenges. Not only is it very cold in winter, but there's not a lot of light.
Yeah, very true. And so it's the land of the midnight sun in the summer, and the reverse is the case in the winter. So we know that north of the Arctic Circle, the sun doesn't crest the horizon on the 21st of December. So the further north you go, the fewer daylight hours. And it certainly is a tremendous challenge to think of a bird being able to hunt, a bird that relies on sight, being able to hunt during those very low light conditions. And the deer falcons have fortunately have eyesight that's incredibly well adapted to detecting movement under very low light conditions. And I think they're the architecture of the eye, although I don't believe it's been studied, I think it resembles the architecture of an owl, which is is a very high proportion of the kind of receptor cells that do very well under low light. They detect motion very well and can collect images with very low light conditions. So that works very much for the gyrfalcon. But he's further constrained because when it is cold and there's limited daylight, the ptarmigan he relies on typically uses these snow roofs, so it's buried in the snow for a substantial amount of the day. So things are certainly a challenge for the gyrfalcon.
I know, it's incredible that they survive at all through that season. It's just amazing. I mean, these ptarmigans are burrowing in the snow. Do they ever watch, like, there's other mammals like foxes that could stir up ptarmigan? Do they ever watch other animals to see if they put up ptarmigan?
Yes, for sure. And I think the gyrfalcon is very much, I think it's, he very much tries to exploit these opportunities. And they're often seen following a fox, and for that obvious reason that the fox is hunting ptarmigan and is likely to erupt them out of their snow roofs. So the gyrfalcon tends to capitalize on that. And, you know, I have a dog, a golden retriever, that I've had for a number of years and two before that. And I've always noticed in the summer and the fall when I'm walking on the tundra, you always attract a gyrfalcon, or often do, that I think are attracted to the dog. And I think they've adapted to use animals like that. And the Kafka people years ago claimed that they used to use gyrfalcons as a messenger to help them find caribou. And I suspect what they were doing was following gyrfalcons, who would very likely be tracking caribou for the same reason that the caribou were forcing ptarmigan to explode from their snow roofs. And so gyrfalcons were able to capitalize on that. So that association to me is very interesting.
Wow.
Which appears to have been common knowledge back in the day.
During the short summer period, there are a lot of other birds that are breeding on the tundra. Does the gyrfalcon take advantage of that and take other prey items?
For sure. And there's not, compared to southern areas, it's still fairly spartan in terms of the number of species. There's probably 70 to 90 species nesting in the north, in the subarctic area where I studied gyrfalcons. But certainly there's a real invasion of migrants. Lots of birds show up, and gyrfalcons are able to hunt shorebirds and waterfowl, and in particular, they show a preference, it seems, to Arctic ground squirrels. And Arctic ground squirrels live in the north, and they hibernate in the winter, so they're not available in the winter, but they come out in the spring, and they tour, producing lots of youngsters for gyrfalcons. And I think they're a really handy prey for gyrfalcons. They've got this elongate form, and they're active above these dens during the summer. And so they make for, I think, a relatively easy prey for gyrfalcons. And there's lots of them when things are good. And so gyrfalcons, both in the work that I was doing and in studies in Alaska, it's found that gyrfalcons shift very much toward Arctic ground squirrels, particularly in midsummer.
You wrote that of the waterfowl that they go after, harlequin ducks are most often taken?
Well, I found that there were more harlequins than other ducks. It's still not a huge, I think there were 9% of the diet I figured was waterfowl. Shorebirds tended to be taken more than waterfowl, but of the waterfowl that they took, the harlequin ducks showed up the most. And they're called canyon ducks up here, and they nest by these fast-moving creeks in canyon country. And for some reason, gyrfalcons appear to be effective at killing harlequin ducks and catching them. And it could well be because their flight isn't like a pintail or a green-winged teal that can explode off the water very quickly and get airborne. These things probably are a little more laborious when they're flying from one place to another.
It was amazing to read. Here we have the largest falcon in the world. It's a heavy, large bird, amazingly powerful. Yet, in its breeding habitat, it does have enemies that are other birds.
Yeah, and I think that's one part of the work that I was doing that intrigued me probably as much as anything is the relationship it has with these other birds, notably the golden eagle. And anybody who's watched an encounter between a golden eagle and a gerfalcon will know that gerfalcons seem to express a hatred toward golden eagles that, beyond anything that that they have toward anything else. And so it's really... it was very intriguing to me that I found a correlation between the number of golden eagle nests and the number of gerfalcon nests. And when the gerfalcons were low in numbers, there was more golden eagles in numbers. And, you know, we're not talking about a great sample size, but still the correlation was there. And I suspect that it's quite a determinant on how successful a gerfalcon can be. They likely have to avoid areas around a golden eagle nest because golden eagles are very effective pirates, and also they would, if they can, they would try to kill a gerfalcon. So I think a gerfalcon has to be very mindful of the golden eagle nest around their nest site, so they probably have to venture farther to find prey, and I think that adds a constraint to what may be already a tough go of it when ptarmigan are low in numbers.
Well, you write in the book that if a gerfalcon takes a ptarmigan and a golden eagle comes to challenge it, if the gerfalcon stays to try to defend its prey, it's more often than not going to end up not well for the gerfalcon.
For sure, yeah. And golden eagles are well known to plunge into... They can be viewed maybe in some ways as reckless hunters, but they're so robust that they can fall out of the sky. And of course, a gerfalcon is at its mercy. Golden eagles are considerably larger than a gerfalcon. And in the air, of course, the gerfalcon is much superior. But on the ground, when he's defending prey, he's no match for a golden eagle.
Now, when did they start breeding in March?
Yeah, I found that they started courting in the last half of February, and then they first lay their eggs. The earliest eggs I recorded was in late March. Typically, they were first week of April, but late March, yes, and so it's still winter up there, and the migration is still a long ways away, and the Arctic ground squirrels aren't up, so there be the importance of ptarmigan.
What's the average clutch size?
Of a gerfalcon, they're typically three or four, but I think they've been recorded as high as five and two, but two is more unusual. It's usually three or four.
Is there a lot of nest fidelity? Do they return to the same nest every year?
I suspect they are. I suspect a pair is the male and the female are returning to the nest site they were occupying last year, particularly if they were successful at that nest. It's difficult to know for sure without marking the birds, but my sense was that they were the same birds based on some of their behavior, and also a few of them looked a little different than your typical gerfalcon that appeared to be at the same nesting site year after year. So I think acquiring a territory is extremely important for a gerfalcon, and I think they'll hold on to it to the extent they can. It does interest me, though, if there's any competition for preferred nest sites.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have a nice little cavity, a little alcove, that's a great little maternity ward for gerfalcons, do the males compete for that nest site? It's something I don't know, but it would be certainly interesting to understand that aspect of their behavior.
Well, how long does it take for them to reach sexual maturity, in other words, ready to breed?
I think captive bred gerfalcons have been known to produce eggs in their second or third year, but in the wild, I suspect it's after 4 years that they're able to start breeding.
So what are these teenage gerfalcons doing? I think the word for them is they're floaters.
Yes, they're floaters, and I think they're doing their best to survive. And And of course, if you think of their cycle being 10 years and you think of them being capable of occupying a territory halfway through the cycle, it poses a challenge for these youngsters because if they're produced when times are good, when it's time to acquire a territory, there's a lot fewer ptarmigan. So it's probably really weeds out those youngsters that aren't as capable as the more superior gerfalcons.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and we could talk about this book for hours, but I have to ask you, and you do address this in the book, what is the long-term future for gerfalcons in the face of climate change?
Well, that's a very, you know, I think that's a very interesting question that everybody's asking these days on multiple species, what effect climate change is happening. Now, I think that the one thing that I've learned through the literature is that these the cycles may be changing. There might be a change in the length of the cycle or the amplitude of the cycle, and there's very much concern that that might be having an impact on gerfalcons.
Oh,
I would be particularly concerned if the trough in these cycles dips to very low numbers and doesn't bounce back for a number of years. It could well be that there's just not enough ptarmigan for them when things are grim. And but when you look at ptarmigan's ability to survive in the north, willow ptarmigan probably fare pretty well, I would guess, because you're going to get more shrubs advancing
into
the tundra areas, and more willows make for more willow ptarmigan. Rock ptarmigan probably are compromised more through climate change. But again, these are questions that I'm sure people are embarking on studies to try to look more closely at this, and I can only really speak from what I know from the literature. I haven't noticed a drastic change in the number of gerfalcons or ptarmigan in the areas that I traipse around in the summer, but I suspect it's certainly a potential problem.
We're out of time. My guest tonight has been northern ecologist Norman Baroncello. He has spent 44 years in Canada's Arctic and subarctic in some of the most beautiful areas I've ever seen in photographs as a biologist, naturalist guide, and advisor to the Cascadena. But you try to pick up a copy of his book. It's called Gerfalcon, The One Who Stays All Winter. Norman, it's been a real pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark. I really appreciated the opportunity to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.